Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. One of our listeners, I believe it's a listener, sent a message the other day through LinkedIn, which is one of the many ways you can get in touch with us, that I had to unpack a little bit, unravel a little bit. At first it was, hey, can I ask you a question about reliability? Yeah, sure. And what's your question? And he says, well, do you know about halt testing? And I was, yes. And he says, well, we want to do a halt test on our plastic enclosure. And filling in some of the details here, shorten up this conversation. And we want to know if using Peck's equation, which includes terms for temperature and humidity, and it's for a specific failure mechanism from Peck's original papers. And then it's, well, what activation energy should we use? And so do you pick up anything in here that doesn't look right or smell right or sound right?
Yeah, I'm starting to get a little bit. But how did the conversation go?
It's still ongoing, but it was basically, it's like, all right, if you're trying to do a highly accelerated life test, then that's unrelated to acceleration factors other than in concept, is we're going to apply step stress for multiple stresses in order to discover weaknesses in a design or a process. So we're going to find where the margins are. And that's the concept of halt. It's not really intended to be a life test. Now, on the other hand, maybe you're using that term to mean an accelerated life test, in what I would call an ALT. And then in which case, you're using an equation for a piece of material that really isn't related to what Peck and his colleagues developed that equation for.
Right.
And so
right.
I was like,
I'm, you know, if I go back to the history on this, and I really, really appreciate having a career that allowed me to interface with some very, very smart people. Greg Hobbs was one of them. Mm-hmm. And the working at General Motors at a time when we were just starting to change our mindset. And we had done pretty good research, very good research into accelerated life testing, understanding, not myself personally, I was more on the management side of it, but having people that work in the group that really understand the models very well and understand the mathematics that goes into accelerated life testing. And then along came Greg Hobbs and others that said, well, wait a minute, what if we just, and then the whole step stress body of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And what if we just go all the way to discover what the failures are and don't try to understand all the mathematics at the same time? And that was like a whole different mindset, because when we started introducing halt into GM, the management would say very typically, you're over my head, because I need to know where we are exactly. I need to know if we have a failure, what the likelihood, mm-hmm, of that failure being in our product, in what point in the life cycle.
Right.
And we go, well, that's not really where we're headed here. So it's very interesting to watch the dual path of accelerated life testing and highly accelerated life testing, and then how they even in later years seem to, at least some people said they could come together.
That's
a completely different subject.
Yeah, that's a whole nother subject. But I think in this particular question, if it's really halt they want to do with the intent, and this goes back to our last discussion, Carl, is what are you trying to achieve if you're going to the lab to do either one of these tests? If I want to know how it will fail, I mean, just I need to know what's likely to fail or what will fail. And so I apply meaningful stresses and I force a failure to occur. Now I have a failure mechanism, which I can then go analyze and sort out. And maybe it's just, oh, we didn't expect it to fail there. Let's go back to our design and rethink this a little bit and make it more robust. And that's a common purpose for HALT, H-A-L-T, and it's a valid purpose. And that's what Greg Hobbs and others, you know, said, hey, you know, in the concept, in the theory, I had this explained to me years and years ago, is like, so when you look at your product, you have, you know, hundreds of components and maybe thousands of failure mechanisms. You're not going to make all of them perfect, ever. There's always going to be a finite probability that one of these mechanisms, all of these mechanisms could occur. But the key is that some of them are more likely to occur than others. And so one of our roles is to sort out which are the ones that have the least margin, which are the ones that are most likely to fail. And then it was kind of this concept of stress strength. And I think he was a mechanical engineer in background. He said, let's say you have two distributions, the stress and the strength, you know, and if they're designed where they're really close, they overlap and you have a higher probability of them, a weak component experiencing a strong stress and failing. If you separate them, that's the basic concept, is that you have more margin. And then he said, it gets complicated because then we go make these things. So the amount of strength varies because of material variability, process variability, manufacturing variability, and then aging, the stuff will change in its ability to be strong in over time. And then the environment. We get customers that decide, well, it's working in my house. How about I use it on the top of the mountain when I go mountain climbing? So the environment changes and the stresses we see changes and it accumulates and does all this stuff. HALT is perfect for that.
Yes, it is. Well, it, depending, of course, if you have the capability, the chamber facilities and what have you to be able to do it well. Mm-hmm. But yes, it is. I'm thinking back to when I was writing my FMEA book and I collaborated with Kels and Dr. Pecht and some of his associates on what was called back then, it probably still is, FMMEA, Failure Mode Mechanism and Effects Analysis. Mm-hmm. And this was an interesting, and I collaborated with them on a paper that essentially does an FMEA, but then one of the columns is failure mechanism. And then they go to the mechanism type and then the failure model. Mm-hmm. So basically they identify the failure mechanisms that they're most concerned about based on FMEA type analysis. And then the output is what failure model would we need to use to be able to control that failure mechanism. And so then that would generate the recommended actions. It also has the occurrence and severity so that you can see which of those failure mechanisms are the highest risk.
That's right.
And then which models do you then need to work on to address those mechanisms? So it's a very interesting way to organize. It's not a breakthrough scientifically. It's more of an organization of the thought process of going from failure mechanism to model to improving designs.
It provides a whole lot more coherent way of going about doing that. And it assumes that you're familiar with what models work for which failure mechanisms. And I think that's where part of this question that I got gets a little confused. Is, well, we know that we want to run a temperature, I'm hypothetically thinking here, is that the thought process may have been, and I've seen it happen in other circumstances, well, we have a temperature humidity chamber, and we commonly run a temperature humidity test. And if I go to the textbooks, one of the acceleration models that's frequently cited includes temperature humidity. And it's associated with Peck, P-E-C-K, not Michael Peck from Kels, different Peck. Mm-hmm. And what that paper did is he gathered, I think, a couple hundred different studies that were done for plastic encapsulated components, you know, the epoxy coated, the little black chips that you see on circuit boards. And this was very early on when it was transitioning from metal cans to enclose the transistors to putting them on a lead frame with little gull wing leads coming out of the package, and then encapsulated it in an epoxy, the black epoxy that we see on components. And it's a plastic. And the idea was is that early on they had trouble with that process actually sealing, because if you don't seal the active components from the environment, you get electromigration and corrosions of different kinds, that humidity and contaminants get inside and very readily destroy a transistor component. And so the tests were developed for that. Lots and lots of people were trying to sort this out. There were hundreds of studies done to experiment with this, and they knew that temperature and humidity were stresses that would accelerate that failure mechanism of this lack of seal that would manifest in corrosion on transistors and CMOS components. I've seen this formula being used for solar panels. We have, you know, it's a sheet of plywood-sized device, and they're looking at the lack of seal between laminates of the glass on top, corroding the CMOS-based solar collectors.
You need to know, for every type of model, you need to know what the assumptions are, what the limitations are, what the I'll call it the vulnerability. In other words, where it no longer applies. You need to know that just as well as you know the mathematics and the model itself.
That's right.
Because if you go outside of those assumptions, and this happens so often, is people get their really experience in a certain type of model or approach. You can go back to something as we don't want to go down this path too far, but mean time between failure has certain assumptions in it.
Yep.
And that, but once you go outside of those assumptions, which is very easy to do, you can't keep walking the same path. So somehow the teaching and the subject of models needs to be balanced with the emphasis on where the limitations are, what the assumptions are going into it, so people can think all of that at the same time. That was kind of a mouthful to
point out. Yeah, well, part of the issue, I believe, is the standards that are common in reliability engineering, and I suspect common in other fields also, is they often don't include, here's a formula for, you know, doing a test, and if you run 8 samples, then you're good to some criteria. And what, I mean, you can't write a generic, at least to me, it's not feasible to write a generic test plan for temperature and humidity that applies to all technologies.
Well, no, it doesn't. You're not including the very important aspect of failure mechanism. You know, what specific is the mechanism that you're trying to unearth and see?
Right. And so the issue I have with the, if the question is based on, well, we want to run an accelerated test and we're using temperature and humidity, and temperature and humidity does have, it applies appropriate stresses for some polymer systems. I grant that. It oxidation is and moisture are two stresses that really can harm polymers and finishes and things like that. And I don't know exactly what they were trying to evaluate, but it goes back to this particular discussion is, well, start with the failure mechanism. What is it that you're trying to analyze or understand? And if you don't know what the failure mechanism, well, then HALT's a pretty decent tool to help you identify them. So then you can figure out whether you need to solve it or study it or do something else. But once you have a failure mechanism, then it's back to Michael Peck in this fancy FMEA where you say, well, we understand the cause and severity, but underneath this cause is there's this and maybe more specific failure mechanisms, and then those mechanisms may or may not have specific models. It's a great way for Michael and his group of graduate students to go figure out new physics of failure models that are relevant to what you need to go do. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot out there already. So you can, if you understand the mechanism, you can probably find a model or something that's reasonably to do it. If not, you got to go develop your own. You can't just pick one off the shelf. And
this is so fascinating because nobody's going to be expert in all the different models.
No.
It's not possible. So you need to know where your knowledge limitation is. And then if you bring an expert in, we need to frame it. If we're talking about fatigue and you end up with a Kaufman-Manson, or you're talking about corrosion and you end up with some model, you have to ask. If you don't know, you always need to ask, what are the limitations? What are the assumptions that go into it? And not just automatically assume that it applies 100%. Keep framing that the boundaries around where the model works and where it doesn't work. Because you can't, yourself can't be expert in all of this, but you need to ask the right questions.
Yeah. When I go back to my very first accelerated test, it was a polymer system that was, it's a heating cable, but if it oxidized, it wasn't able to produce as much heat. So we knew that that was the mechanism. So we knew we could use the Arrhenius equation. We actually even knew what the nature of this chemical reaction was. And so we had all kinds of thermal chambers, and we'd throw our products and power them up and put them in these chambers and monitor the change in its ability to produce heat over time. One of the underlying assumptions that we were using until I said, why is this curving? Why is this plot not straight? The longer I run the test, the more curve I'm getting. And one of the assumptions, and this is from Wayne Nelson's book on accelerated testing, is that they're linear. It doesn't mean it's a straight line on an XY plot. It can be on a log plot or something like that, but it's still straight. The behavior is in a linear fashion from a statistics point of view. And I didn't meet any of those tests. And so the general prevailing knowledge was, if you run this test for 6 months, you get a better result. The product lasts longer. If you run the test for only 2 months, it's going to show that your product is going to fail pretty soon. So think of it as that if you take the starting point and the end point, and it's, I'm waving my hand here, it's coming down, it's starting at point one, and it's coming down, and it goes like to 80%, and then it starts to flatten out, and it starts to degrade at a slower rate. And so if you run it longer, the slope between the front and the back is more shallow, and it will project out to last a long time. If you take the first reading and the first week's reading, it's almost pointing straight down, and it's going to project that your sample is going to fail very fast. And in the physical phenomena was that the chemical reaction was self-retarding. The more it occurred, the more it slowed itself down from occurring. So it didn't have a constant activation energy. I mean, the actual individual chemical reaction was the same, but the availability of oxygen was being retarded. So it just didn't have the opportunity to react. But it was one of those things where I read Wayne's, set of assumptions in his book. It said, if you're going to run this kind of test, one of the assumptions is that it's linear. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And so I did some more research. I probably called Wayne and said, hey, what do you mean by that? And he goes, well, here's how you test it. And I said, oh, we don't meet that at all. And I'm like, wow, okay, let me back up. We got to use a completely different technique to analyze this.
You need to ask the right question. And that is so important, because you don't want to just walk the path without your eyes wide open. I would say this, that we have a lot of listeners, and which we appreciate, is I really suggest people become at least generally aware of the body of knowledge of failure mechanisms, both from a mechanical and electrical mm-hmm. point of view. And
don't forget software there, Carl.
Yeah. And then from that, become generally aware of what the different models are, and then maybe become expert in some of the failure mechanisms and some of the models, but you can't do everything. But then also understand what the limitations are and the assumptions, and keep asking questions, because this is a subject that is evolving very quickly as we move more and more towards analysis replacing physical testing. And as we move to shorter and shorter product development times, we have to be able to think with this whole subject. And part of that thinking is knowing what questions to ask of whom.
Yep. And very well said. And, you know, we've talked about it before, Carl, of doing a whole series just on specific failure mechanisms, associated models.
Which, love to do that.
Yeah. When we leave it to our listeners to suggest, you know, what's your favorite failure mechanism or model, and we could dive into deeper discussion about those things, you can head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a contact form there. And as many of you already know, Carl and I and the others are available on LinkedIn or through email, or even our phone numbers for many of us are up on our about pages on Ascendo. So that might be something. If we get some good responses here, or some response, which I fully suspect we will, we'll probably get a whole series of topics to dive into. And It should be fun, and I think you're exactly right. It's understanding the assumptions and understanding the right questions to ask is key to a lot of these things. So look forward to those discussions.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks, Carl. Enjoy the rest of your day. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.